want to speak, we absolutely need you to sign into the testimony sheet, too. So that's important. It's only for the public record. Yes?
Is the testimony sheet different from the sign-in sheet?
Yes.
All right.
Not everybody here cares to speak.
I didn't know that.
That's okay. You can come and sign. So to put it all in context, as you know, the legislature directed DWR in 2014 to develop regulations to include renewable thermal into the alternative portfolio standard. And there's been a lot of staff hours since then trying to write these regulations and get them to a presentable form to begin to get your input and feedback to us. I think it's important for you to recognize that we don't consider the regulations that are in front of you as the do-all and end-all. We look at them as more of a working document. With your input, we can alter, make changes to, and improve upon them, hopefully. It's really critical to us, as we read and listen to your testimony, that criticism is good. But criticize, but provide alternatives to maybe criteria that we have listed is very helpful, because then we have something to work with. So just keep that in mind as you're providing us with written comments or your oral comments. And please, get the comments into us. Samantha will take them all in and distribute them amongst the team members that are working on this. They will be read. They will be discussed. Internally, not by me, but by other folks, because I'm leaving DOAR in a few days. But please submit your testimony to us, and we'll definitely take them seriously. Also, during the rulemaking period, it's important that we cannot engage with you one-on-one by phone call, by email. We really need to keep this an open process, so it's important that we have everything public and available, be very transparent on the whole process. So with that, we have a number of people that signed in to speak, and we're just going to go down the list. Let me just ask my colleagues here, is anything else that I missed or want to add to?
No, that's good. We won't need a time limit. I think we've got enough time here to cover folks. Do try to keep your, if you've got written testimony, you don't need to read it to us. Do try to summarize to the extent that you can, but we won't do that unless we're running real late, and I don't think we'll do that. We need to do that.
Okay, so the order I'm going to go is based on it signed in. So Nathan, you're right on top of the list. Would you like to begin, please?
Sure. Good afternoon. I'm Nathan Latwal, and I come before you today as the Executive Director of the Massachusetts Forest Alliance. The Massachusetts Forest Alliance approaches this topic from a variety of angles as it balances the needs of its constituent base. Small and large landowners, forestry professionals such as foresters, loggers, and truckers, and those that use forest products such as mills, artisans, pellet manufacturers, and more. We're a small membership-based trade group that advocates for a strong and sustainable forest economy. And that forest economy is facing some serious challenges. Increased pest pressures due to product import and changing weather patterns, low fuel prices that lead to a lack of demand for our low-grade material, a loss of local customers for much of our other products as mills close, and those that are left dealt with a customer base increasingly divorced from the natural resource-based aspects of the economy that produce their food and fiber. Society is placing a greater and greater level of restriction on how we in the natural resource-based economy manage our land to supply the products that drive our economy. While inclusion in the alternative portfolio standard will not solve all of our problems, it's amazing to realize all the different ways in which displacing fossil fuels with local wood and slowing climate change will, in fact, make a meaningful difference in our industry and the lives of the citizens of the Commonwealth. First and foremost of those is the creation of a market for our low-grade material. In order to produce the high-quality timber that our forests are capable of, we must have an outlet for the low-quality products that need to be removed. The removal allows the remaining trees on the property to grow in both quantity and quality. That increase is crucial to the long-term sustainability of working landscapes here in Massachusetts, and it is undeniable that sustainably managed working forests don't just create more jobs and higher property values. They sequester more carbon, create cleaner water, and provide habitat for some of our most threatened species. On behalf of my members, I'd like to thank you for the release of these draft regulations. This process obviously began long ago, and it's encouraging to see the continuing. While there are many small points of clarification and change that we're seeking, and we'll comment on those in writing by the deadline, I'd like to take a moment to focus on a couple of the larger items. The Massachusetts Forest Alliance remains dismayed by the clear intent of the regulations to disallow the use of green chips. MFA recognizes the inherent reduction in efficiency levels at the boiler from burning green chips, but excluding them entirely for this reason loses sight of the complications imposed on the supply chain and the added cost for drying chips, either passively or actively. The most efficient and sustainable way to handle and process such chips is for them to be chipped on site during harvest, transported directly to an end user, and deposited there for use as fuel. Requiring drying doubles the retail cost of such chips due to the inherent inefficiencies and makes it unlikely that a significant number of such chip burning facilities will be installed. While maintaining the air quality provisions at their current level would necessitate the addition of equipment to clean particulate matter for stacks burning green chips, such a condition would be a reasonable alternative to precluding their use entirely. This would result in several incentives remaining to burn dry chips over green chips, more tons per BTU in the fuel, more efficient systems for burning that fuel, and therefore more credits per ton of input fuel, but would not preclude their use entirely. We're also concerned with the lack of clarity and inclusion for cordwood. Cordwood is one of the greatest opportunities for these regulations to engage homeowners in making positive choices about their fuel supply and in assisting small distributed rural businesses. Cordwood, by its very nature, does not travel far, so money spent on this non-bag fuel is kept locally, with most of the dollars going directly into payroll because of the high labor requirements behind most cordwood manufacturing. While bag fuels are becoming more common and these regulations provide good provisions to make them eligible, most bag fuels are sold by intermediaries and transported greater distances in a highly processed form that adds a lot of convenience and consumer flexibility to the product, but it also lacks the level of direct connection to the producer that the local forest and the local forest that comes from cordwood. This connection is meaningful as we attempt to educate people about their forests and how their heating choices can either accelerate or slow climate change and environmental degradation. We'll comment in writing about the exact steps that we would suggest to better embrace cordwood as a sustainable and renewable fuel supply. Finally, MFA has concerns with the complexity and the wording around the provisions that are intended to guarantee a sustainably harvested fuel when that comes from the forest. We feel that the wording around the exact role of the Forest Guild guidelines, long-term management plans, forester licensing, and certification is confusing at best. For instance, it's unclear just how an out-of-state forester must be licensed or certified and by whom. If a forester must comply with all portions of the Forest Guild guidelines, including such future research priorities and a humble approach to forestry, or just with the guidelines as they relate to harvest activities. And if the fuel suppliers themselves must be certified under a certification program that they wish to make a claim under, or if just the fuel that they're selling needs to be certified under that. So again, these are some of the major points. We'll be commenting more in writing by the deadline, and we would like to thank you and if you would please pass along our appreciation to the administration for taking this important step in the process. It's meaningful, and it's much appreciated. Thank you.
Thank you, Nathan. Next up is Noah Anina Stone. I'm sorry, is that your name?
Did I write Noah Anina?
No one has it.
She has nothing to say. I have something to say. Heather.
I'm Noah Stone, and this is obviously my wife, Heather. We are here representing Hayes Forest Products in Orange, Massachusetts. We are a small family-owned business, and we are here to support regulations that promote sustainable management of our forests and also help us move low-grade material in these difficult markets. We need the ability to remain competitive with the volatile fossil fuel markets. And I think that's all I have to say. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'd like to add that.
Oh, sure.
I feel like I see this issue through a number of different lenses. As a homeowner, you know, we heat with wood, and anything that can promote that and that can promote the use of, as Nate said, wood that is transported as little distance as possible. I mean, we can literally get cordwood 100 yards from our house, and I think that should be promoted. I think that's really great, other than bringing fossil fuels from afar. As a landowner, I think it's really important that we incentivize management to take low-quality products out. It's so important for the future of our forests. As someone involved in a family business, we do forestry and milling. There are smaller than a handful number of mills left in the state, and I think anything that can help these businesses stay afloat is so important, so important. And also as a producer, I mean, talking about burning fuels, for example, in our kilns, anything that can help that business stay afloat, transitioning from fossil fuels to locally sourced wood products that additionally help the health of the forest and are economically smart, are really good for our local economy, for our state economy. I just think it's a potential win all around for everyone in the community. So thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, both of you. Okay. Richard Bonte.
I'm Richard Bonte from SunSource Energy Products. We're wholesale distributors of solar thermal products from New Jersey. We have several customers that we sell to regularly in Massachusetts. And I'm here to comment on the regulations regarding the determination of the alternate energy credits for the solar thermal program for hot water and for heating. That program, I understand, has been designed to determine the number of alternative energy credits for solar thermal panels based upon the SRCC Category D rating. There are a number of different rating levels that the SRCC has assigned to solar panels from A to E, and those ratings are based upon how many degrees warmer the solar panels are than the air temperature at a given point of the day. And the utilization of Category D says that the state of Massachusetts basically for the entire year has a situation where the air temperature is 90 degrees colder than the temperature of the solar panels. I believe, and most of the people that I've discussed this with in the industry believe, that the correct rating for Massachusetts should be rating C, which is 45 degrees difference between the panel temperature and the air temperature. While it's true that Massachusetts may be in Category D range for January and February, during the summer months, Massachusetts is in the Category B range, which is a 10-degree difference between the panel temperature and the air temperature. But for the average for the year, Category C is the better fit. The reason I'm bringing this to your attention is the use of Category D creates a rather disproportionate rebate for the use of evacuated tubes, which do perform much better when the temperature differential between the solar panels and the air is great. When the temperature differential is moderate, the evacuated tubes and flat plate collectors perform equally, and when the temperature differential is less than 45 between the solar panels and the air temperature, the flat plate collectors actually outperform the evacuated tubes. On an annual basis, both simulations and data from the SRCC, the same organization that does the panel rating, shows that on an annual basis in Massachusetts, the difference between the two types of technologies is about 1%. There are two different types of ratings that the SRC develops. One is instantaneous panel performance, which is what is being used now in the regulation. And then there is system performance analysis, which is commonly referred to as OG300. OG300 is really a much better means of evaluating the output of a solar thermal system on an annual basis. One of the flaws of the OG300 program, however, is that there are not a lot of OG300 systems rated. So in many cases, you may have installers who want to install systems that are not in the OG300 database. What is commonly done in most other states is the use of an accepted solar simulation program. There are many on the market that are recognized by various states, F-Chart, PolySun, just to name a few. And that's what I would suggest be used for systems that do not have an OG300 rating. Otherwise, what's being happened is the consumer is being shortchanged regarding what he can install because he's not going to receive an adequate rebate if he puts in flat plate collectors as proposed, versus evacuated tubes. So he's being driven to one section of the market, which may not provide the best system for his home on an annual basis. In addition, there is a rather large area that is not discussed in the regulations, but I have been told is technically covered by the regulations, and that is solar pool heating. Solar pool heating nationwide, as well as I'm sure in Massachusetts, is a rather large consumer of fossil fuel energy and greenhouse gases. By having the solar collector category for the evaluation here being category D, it means that solar pool heating technology is not eligible at all unless evacuated tubes are installed for solar pool heating. Evacuated tubes are probably the worst choice for solar pool heating because most solar pool heating takes place in what is called the B range, which is when air temperatures are only 9 degrees difference between panel temperature and air temperature. So that relatively inexpensive unglazed solar collectors for solar pool heating will tremendously outperform flat plates at one-fifth the cost. So that's another technology we'd like to see be able to be recognized. So my recommendation would be to the board is that either use simulation software that is acceptable to the state or have a three-tier rating system. And that is if you want to stay with solar collector instantaneous ratings, use Category D for those systems that are primarily for heating, Category C for those systems that are primarily for domestic hot water, and Category B for pool heating systems. Or use generally recognized software that is available on the market. I'd like to commend Massachusetts, both the CEC program and the DOER, for having what I consider to be one of the best programs I've seen. I've been in this business for 40 years, and I've seen programs in many states, and Massachusetts has done more, I think, than anybody else. And hopefully this will help get more solar installed and the right solar installed for each homeowner. Thank you.
Thank you. Mary. Mary Booth.
My name is Mary Booth. I'm director of the Partnership for Policy Integrity, a nonprofit that I founded after working here in Massachusetts on the state's regulations that took renewable energy credits away from standalone biomass plants in the electricity sector. Since that time, I've worked nationally on this issue and now working internationally, looking at the effects of the pellet market on what it's doing to greenhouse gas emissions in for Europe. Because what's happening right now is that there's massive clear-cutting of forests in the southeast to make wood pellets that are being shipped to Europe to be burned in electricity plants, converted coal plants. And they aren't counting the carbon. We've always held up Massachusetts and the process that Massachusetts engaged in, commissioning the Manomet study and engaging in a science-based process to determine net carbon emissions and to reduce those emissions, as an example of policy done properly. And we've used that nationally and internationally as an example of the right way to go about making bioenergy policy. Unfortunately, I think that Massachusetts is about to lose its leadership role in this regard because of the way that I see this moving forward, this process moving forward that's providing incentives for thermal bioenergy without conducting the appropriate assessments of carbon emissions and net carbon emissions as required under the Global Warming Solutions Act. Specifically, and we'll be submitting detailed comments on this, I don't see evidence that the state is getting ready to engage in a real round of greenhouse gas accounting for these new regulations, particularly with regard to the incentivization of use of wood pellets, because making wood pellets is a very carbon-intensive and wood-intensive process. And I don't even see any evidence that there's cognizance of this by the state, that the greenhouse gas accounting that's been done in the past isn't appropriate to be applied here. A life cycle analysis for pellets, which I've done, and I will provide those data to you, which you were free to check, shows that the net emissions are considerably greater than burning chips per megawatt hour or per useful MMBTU. And that needs to be taken into account, because let's remember that the goal of our renewable energy regulations in Massachusetts is not to keep the wood products industry operating, but to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. That's why taxpayers are paying federal credits to facilities like this, and that's why ratepayers pay extra on their electricity bill, because they want to promote renewable energy that actually reduces greenhouse gas emissions, because most of us in this room, I hope, know that greenhouse gases are a real thing and that global warming is a real thing and that we need to do something about it fast. My preliminary analyses, and we'll be doing more detailed analyses in the future, are that any significant upscaling of wood for energy in New England would significantly cut into, no pun intended, the carbon sequestration capacity of New England's forests. You don't get to have it both ways. Forests are either taking up carbon and growing and being used maximally to sequester greenhouse gases, or you can exploit them for energy. And you can do a little bit of exploiting for energy and not significantly impact that, but you go beyond a certain point, you are going to be in a situation where you're no longer sequestering carbon to the potential that those forests have. We went into the Paris Climate Agreement and came out of the Paris Climate Agreement making promises about what the United States would do on our net carbon emissions, and forest carbon sequestration is part of that. We are counting on forests to continue sequestering carbon and putting in place programs that incentivize that, and then relying on old crummy science to justify it without actually looking at the net greenhouse gas emissions is irresponsible, and it's not what I expect from Massachusetts, which to this point has been exemplary in how they've handled this. Fundamentally, my ask is that the state engage in a real transparent greenhouse gas analysis of the impacts of this policy, which I don't believe you've done, and we'll be happy to help you in any way we can. We'll provide you with the data that we already have, and we expect to see that before these regulations are implemented. Thank you.
Thanks, Mary. James.
Rob, thank you. James McCaffrey, also with the Partnership for Policy Integrity. And Mary covered a lot of stuff. We're going to be submitting written comments, of course, by the deadline. We'll have a lot of detailed data and analysis in there. I just wanted to flag a couple of high-level things. Mary did also touch on these, but I want to emphasize it. Essentially, when you're burning wood, whether it's chips or pellets, you are emitting more of the stack than you are for fossil fuels. For any meaningful time frame that you want to try and recapture that carbon, this increased emission rate continues for as long as you operate a facility. So say you build a facility and you're operating it for 40 years. And say under the best scenario, you can recapture a portion of those emissions within 10 years. You don't even start to play catch-up on that until a facility that has a lifespan of 40 years is turned off. And right now, we're at a critical juncture where we've passed 400 parts per million in the atmosphere for carbon, and we actually need to be doing everything we can to be sequestering that carbon, not removing carbon sinks, including also the important role that soil plays in recapturing that carbon. and we should not be incentivizing or promoting policies that quite simply, when you look at the science, the best available science, the latest science, you are going to be increasing carbon emissions in the atmosphere for the foreseeable future. It's just it's really that simple. And the other concern that we have that will also be outlined in the comments that we're going to submit is that with the recent SJC ruling that requires that the state issue regulations to look at categories of sources and develop a program to have declining emissions over time under the Global Warming Solutions Act, when you're going to be putting in place a new program that is going to possibly be increasing those emissions without having completed those regulations that are requiring that you look at all the different sources and categories of sources, they're clearly very out of sync with what the SJC ruled on what's required under the Global Warming Solutions Act to deal with carbon emissions in the Commonwealth. That's it, because that's basically what I wanted to say. But we'll follow up with more detailed comments on this. And I also want to emphasize that we have been a leader on this. We really have been, and the world has turned to Massachusetts and looked at what we did with the biomass regulations that we passed a few years ago. And we're very concerned that there's a real potential to undo that. And I think we can't have any illusions about the fact that there is a real effort right now. I worked extensively on retiring coal plants throughout New England and pushing back against fossil fuels. And we made some real progress on that front, as folks know. And we'll probably be coal-free in New England within the next 10 years. But if we are going to incentivize the massive buildup of a pellet industry that actually wants to promote the conversion of coal boilers across the nation over to pellets as a method and a way to comply with the Clean Power Plan, we shouldn't have any illusions that just doing something here in Massachusetts to try and help forest and landowners to find ways to use low-grade products, that this isn't part of a much broader and bigger effort by the pellet industry to actually ramp up a massive pellet industry that will have massive impacts from deforestation and habitat perspective all across the country, and then, of course, the climate change impacts. But we need to really look at the big picture here and think about the implications of what we're doing in Massachusetts and think about what we've done as a leader and make sure that we stay on the forefront of that. Thank you.
Thank you. Mike.
Greetings. As a consulting forester helping landowners manage thousands of acres of forest land across the state, I support more utilization of forest biomass because without low-grade timber markets, we cannot practice great forestry. Biomass is, in essence, stored solar energy and is a byproduct of our forestry operations, which allows us to grow more high-quality saw timber, which is the main product. Increased markets for forest biomass have produced more forest improvement cuttings, which help landowners manage their woodlots to a high standard by greatly improving timber quality and species composition, improve wildlife habitat, generates income, increases property values as well as timber values, and encourages landowners to keep their land and forest. Biomass markets and improvement cuttings also provide many real green jobs right up the wood supply chain and help to provide many different forest products for consumers and a source of clean, locally produced renewable energy. The use of wood energy is carbon neutral as long as the forests are growing faster than they are being cut. Here in Massachusetts, forests are growing many times faster than they are being cut. There are numerous studies that show the great carbon benefits of biomass utilization. For the last 10 years, I have designed and supervised biomass improvement cuttings on thousands of acres across the state. My work has been highly praised by the DCR service foresters who review my work as being among the best in the business. I have no problem finding work. Work comes to me, as landowners love the work we do. My forestry photo albums have achieved nationwide acclaim through the Society of American Foresters, as well as social media. So if you want to see more great forestry work, then we need more markets for forest biomass, especially in those areas that have no access to any significant low-grade timber markets, such as the Berkshires and the hill towns of Western Mass. Thanks for your time.
Thank you. And I apologize. I should have read your whole name off just for the record. That was Mike Leonard. Next up is John Sears.
That's me. I'm from the town of Holly. I wanted to speak about concerns that have been raised about particulates. And I bring to this issue a number of different perspectives because I'm the chair of the select board in the town of Holly. The select board is also the board of health, so I'm chairman of the select of the board of health. I'm a forest owner, chapter 61. And I've been on an advisory committee to the superintendent of Mohawk Regional School District on wood heat. And I've been a proponent of wood heat systems for our schools. And one of the issues that's been raised at meetings on this subject is the issue of particulates. We were talking about wood pellet heat, particularly. And it certainly raised concerns with, in my mind, that I hadn't had before. And I started looking for information, for studies that would give me the kind of scientific information which would tell me whether this was of how much a concern this really was. I'm still not convinced that it's a major problem, but I have not found a definitive study that's been done of particular emissions. We visited, as an advisory committee to the superintendent, we visited a building, a Greenfield Community College campus that uses a wood pellet system, which we were very impressed with, its efficiency, the very low amount of ash it produced, and no issues of particulates were raised there in that visit. I know that Cooley Dickinson Hospital has a wood chip boiler, I believe, they certainly are concerned with health. So I'm wondering whether any of these facilities in Massachusetts that use this technology have been studied to see, well, are they producing particulates? How much? Is this a dangerous level? What's the effect on people who live in the area? You know, our students in Mohawk, of course, are exposed to a lot of wood smoke because they heat with wood at home, usually, probably 80% of them, and as I do, or have outdoor furnaces for their homes, which are much, much less efficient than pellet boilers. So I guess my concern is, you know, I would urge DOER to do a study, if no one exists, on particulates, and to look at particular boilers that are operational and see what the story is. You know, are they producing, what sort of particulates are they producing, and what sort of danger might they be producing? So, thank you.
Thank you. Brad Roberts.
Yeah, that's me. My only point of coming here today was to promote chip energy. The pellet industry, as far as carbon producing, before the pellet is even made, the carbon output is so much more than anywhere in the chip industry. The chip industry has proven that you can't go any more than 40 miles. Before you buy a pellet here in Western Mass, it's already been trucked over 200 miles. Plus, it has to be built and processed in wherever it's being processed, New Hampshire, which is where most of them are coming from right now. The chip industry can be built right here locally, produced by local people, and run by local companies. That's pretty much it.
Thank you, Brad. Charlie Carey.
I run a business out of Worcester called Biomass Production Systems, and I've sold wood-fired boilers primarily into the forest products industry for the last 30 years, mostly in states like Kentucky and Missouri, which, granted, don't have the same environmental standards as New England. So I really don't have a dog in the fight here technologically, but I have long made it sort of a mission to try to move wood energy out of the forest products industry because I think there's so many economic and environmental benefits that come with burning wood locally for heat. And, you know, every day I drive by the remains of 34,000 trees in different stages of grinding and removal from Worcester as a result of the Asian longhorn beetle eradication program. Since there's no market for this material, there's actually a cost to the public of exporting a perfectly good low-carbon fuel. Take just a moment with me and think of the potential to the local economy of using this material as fuel and not paying to export it. And I ask the question, why isn't using better utilization of wood resources a high priority for the Economic Development Office in the state of Massachusetts? Is there anybody here from the Economic Development Office of the state of Massachusetts?
Sorry, I can remind you it's a public hearing on the regulations proposed by the Department of Energy Resources at the Economic Development. Feel free to address them directly. Absolutely.
Regarding the APS program, the state is unquestionably to be recommended for moving forward with a program to support renewable thermal production. Government involvement in the market gives wood to heat credibility among consumers. What follows is my personal opinion, looking at the program from the woods and wanting to maximize public benefit while increasing the value of our wood resources. I understand the need for public sector to promote wood heating technology with the highest and best emission and environmental controls. But you must understand that such a narrow focus does not address the fundamental economic and environmental benefits offered from our wood resources. DCR predicts the state of Massachusetts will lose 5% of our state's trees due to emerald ash borer over the next 10 to 15 years. The wasted wood from the 2011 tornado still scars the landscape. Any forester will tell you our woods continue to be poorly managed because there are no markets for wood which cannot be made into boards. There's actually a crisis right now in forest management, watershed management, fire management, invasive species management, board quality lumber development management, economic development management, which could all be mitigated by better use of wood as a fuel. The current APS program has many of the attributes of the New York State Energy Research and Development Authority program, which is primarily 100% pellet-based. I have always welcomed pellets as a way to expand the market for wood into the suburban homes, but chips and cordwood, I hold, are the highest and best use for local markets and are not given the consideration they deserve in public sector subsidies. The approved NYSERDA list of technologies referred to in the guidelines are pellet systems, not chips. And I question if there are any chip technologies can pass all the tests of the grant threshold. I know the technology which I continue to sell cannot come close to meeting these standards. So I ask the questions, how many chip-based companies are certified to meet all required standards? With that as background, I would like to make two quick comments on the standard. I question why the state of Massachusetts is requiring 30% moisture content to qualify for the subsidy. Why do we need to push beyond what Europe is doing with chips, where 35% is often the standard? Why do regulations always need to get more stringent? I am a true advocate of local communities using their wood resources for maximum public benefit. There are costs to these benefits in the form of emissions. If the public could objectively look at the costs and benefits of using available wood for fuel and the actual local impact on the economy and the environment, I am quite confident that they would avidly support heating local public buildings with wood. people have to store wood to let it dry if they can't afford a dryer. This storage costs money. Local wood to heat offers huge potential benefits. So limiting the moisture content limits opportunity to develop local wood markets. The state should be worried about what comes out of the stack, not the moisture content of the wood going in. I see no point in focusing on moisture content. Second, I sell large wood boilers, and they are all ASME approved. ASME standards are a recommendation for the state's regulators who have discretion to accept or not accept these standards. Small wood to heat manufacturers around the world tested different standards, and are not ASME certified. Our neighbors to the north have truly embraced using wood for fuel, are using the European standard, and this acceptance has opened up the market significantly to newer technologies. So I encourage the state not to acquire this narrow American-based standard when it is clearly a bottleneck to expanding acceptable technologies. In conclusion, the technology I've sold for 30 years is clearly obsolete for today's out-of-the-woods New England-based environmental requirements. I'm okay with that because the market for my company's products is extremely limited compared to the smaller systems supported by APS. The state of Massachusetts is focused on the right market with the greatest opportunity for environmental and economic benefits. I honestly applaud the state's effort to market only the best of the best combustion technology, but this program is clearly a program designed to drive technology and not the market. Today, I simply suggest that this program really needs to complement a complementary program which works to make better use of our wood resources as fuel.
Thank you. Charlie, just one clarification. The Department of Energy Resources has no regulatory authority over ASME as the Department of Public Safety. Just for clarification. Jonathan Parrott?
Never mind.
It is, yes. My name is Jonathan Parrott. I'm a resident of Chesterfield, which is in the beginning of the Berkshires. I'm a licensed forester, a farmer, and perhaps the dreaded S-word of a socialist. I'm an advocate for bottom-up economics, and I'm dismayed to see in some of the draft regulations here the reserve comment for firewood. And so as a proponent, trying to advocate for folks who are not moving their wood far, perhaps cutting and burning their own wood, I'd like to see the state push forward on that. It seems to me that this regulation and legislation is primarily promoting the larger systems with permission to what I see as the majority of wood burners within the state, which are small wood burners. As an example, if one was a small wood burner consuming perhaps 5 cords of wood, and perhaps, just to use numbers, they were burning ash wood because ash obviously is a doomed species within our state. And the numbers of 2 million BTUs being tossed around for a thermal credit, that equates to roughly $1,000 a year for that household. That's not an insignificant income stream for the household from burning 5 cords of wood. It almost offsets the cost of the wood. So I think that's something to be considered. There are many, many, many solid wood burners within the state, and this regulation heavily favors the larger consumers of processed wood, whether it be pelletized or simply chipped. I'd also like to note that there's an omission that to qualify this wood as sustainable, it needs to be under a tree farm system or identified as such with consideration to a long-term forest management plan, also with an oversight of a cutting plan. I'd like to make note that one can harvest wood on their own property, be it within certain tolerances, without a cutting plan. So you may have a forest management plan, a green certification of that forest, but if you're not cutting to a threshold, there's no need to file a cutting plan. So now is that wood, which seems sustainable now because you're cutting at very low quantities, is that wood no longer identifiably sustainable because there's no cutting plan to accompany it? I know few people who heat their houses from their own woods who go to the trouble of filing a cutting plan if their objective is to simply cut under 10 cords of wood. So I would like to see the legislation include the solid wood market. I know that's a great challenge because it's a heterogeneous marketplace where there are many different types of combustion stoves and many different species of wood that may be burned. If this is a challenge for DCR, maybe it needs to be outsourced with an RFP for a third party to go and assess the volume of wood consumed by a particular individual and to authenticate that the combustion device is compatible. I think that's a reasonable request. It could even be built into the reimbursement structure. So those are my thoughts. Thank you.
Thank you. So we have a few more speakers to go through, but let me just ask, after hearing what you've heard, anyone else want to sign up to speak? We still have more time. If you care to, just come on up. Jim Van Valkenburg.
I'm Jim Van Valkenburg with Rolling Energy. We're in Peterborough, New Hampshire. We are the first company in New England to produce dry chips. We call them PDCs. They're precision dry wood chips. They're generally hardwood. They could be of many different species. But specifically, they are aimed to be burned in boilers that are of European origin at this point, mostly. The Frohlings and the Wiesmans and some others. They are rigged up in the about 500,000 BTUs and up. And those are the boilers that could either burn wood pellets or dry chips up to 30 or 35%, depending on what that boiler manufacturer says. We saw this marketplace. It's approximately a third of the marketplace in Europe. And it is virtually non-existent in the United States, especially New England, our focus here. And we find that when we burn these chips, they have very similar properties to wood pellets. The boilers are set up very nicely to burn them. We also know that if you burn chips that are in the 35 to 50-55% moisture range, is that you end up with a lot more particulate, and it ends up needing ESPs and cyclones and expensive mechanicals to be able to clean them up. We're not against the use of green chips, but we certainly want to make people well aware of the benefits of drying the chips. We dry them with our own chips. It's certainly there's some electricity being utilized in this process, but otherwise it's a rather green process with the source of heat being the chips themselves. Our research has shown that if you look at the total life cycle of wood, of the wood chip, and perhaps even pellets, but I'm mainly looking at the chips at this moment, you would find that the total carbon release, especially in the drilling for oil and the drilling for propane, and all of the different other fuels, the methane releases and all of this added up together, is that biomass is a very solid carbon releaser as far as it's on the low end. It's not a bad thing. And I'm thinking to be able to, everybody drove their cars here today. Every single bit of gasoline they burned was non-renewable, all carbon into the atmosphere, every airplane we ride on. And here we've got a fuel that actually has a life cycle that regenerates. We need to keep stimulating this process, even though there may be a crisis in this world. Seems to me that to put the burden on wood and to cancel this industry, which is a very strong industry in New England, New Hampshire has been very successful with their very similar program that you're proposing, and we just feel very strongly that this is something that is fostering jobs, it's fostering, whether it be in the woods or at our site or our mechanics who are installing these boiler systems, which is what my company also does. We're one of the biggest installers of biomass systems that are, again, the high-efficiency systems that I think everybody's looking for. I discourage you from burning just straight-out wet chips, but on the other hand, if we have regulations that are tough enough to say that the particulate matters and so forth need to be at a certain level, it will be more or less self-regulating because the expense of putting in a system, even to offset, say, 30,000 gallons of oil in a school, dry chips become a better proposition because it's very close to the cost of a pellet system versus virtually double for a system that would burn green chips with all the material handling and the concerns and controls that you have to have with that, it becomes a very expensive proposition. Again, kind of self-regulating. On the small side, we definitely don't see a lot of chip action. It usually starts in that 20 to 30,000 gallon range. The RECs are a very important stimulus that we find, and the big thing that the state of New Hampshire has wrestled with is how do you decide exactly how many BTUs this organization has utilized, and they've gone to very scientific equipment, let's say just precise equipment, BTU meters and data accumulators, and that turns into about a $5,000 or even $10,000 addition to the project for some of the scale, and it's hard to downscale that equipment. So that, I think your challenge would be to try to figure out how to offer RECs to smaller organizations, even down to the homeowner scale. It becomes difficult to say you've used this much, and I understand that, and I'd encourage people to use wood and continue to use wood. It's always been an economical way for a person of low income to keep their home and keep their family healthy. Let's see here. Again, I just encourage you to stick with the particulate regulation. We like the idea that the PVCs or this kind of dry or semi-dry chip is being recognized. I think that's a very important development, and it's something that's not that hard to get into if you're an organization that sees this coming. Although the big thing is, it's a chicken and egg. Do I have customers that have the equipment to burn it? Do I have fuel to be able to supply to those customers? And it's a slow ratcheting up, which is what we're doing. We started out at about 1,000 tons 2 years ago, total output, 2,000 tons. Last year, we expect to be about 4,000 tons of 25% dry chips this coming year with about 6 major customers. It's a slow growth proposition, but I encourage it as, the state should encourage this sort of thing. That's all I have.
Thank you, Jim. Glenn Ayers.
I'm Glenn Ayers. I live in Greenfield, and I'm speaking as a private citizen today. I have read through Chapter 251 of the Acts of 2014, which is enabling legislation. It's really unfortunate that a good effort at legislation included the word biomass in it. I'm in favor of most of the regulations having to do with solar thermal and other technologies, but it's really unfortunate that carbon-intensive emitting biomass was included in that act, but it's there, and until the legislation changes, that's the breaks. The wording in the act says that biomass fuel shall be low emission and use energy conversion technologies and fuels that are produced by means of sustainable forestry. That sentence is the man on that loophole. When we were going through the process that was funded by the state to put in large-scale biomass facilities, over $1 million in grants given out to Greenfield and Russell and other places, and then we had to fight that by holding bake sales, essentially, but we did win most of them because they were such a bad idea to begin with. Anyway, we knew at that point when those regulations were passed that the next step would be, because of that one sentence in the Manomet study, thermal biomass. We knew that this was coming. And sure enough, we had a corrupt politician who wiggled it into an act, and it got passed by the legislature because it was included with a lot of good stuff. And biomass got put in there with truly renewable energy when it is clearly not the case that biomass is renewable on any scale that makes a difference. As our state legislature put out a report saying, no time to waste. Well, this is wasting everyone's time. So my suggestion, and I have also read through the proposed regulations, I don't see the emissions performance standards that are protective of public health. I don't see that in here anywhere. I'm not sure where that's coming from. I don't see any discussion of reducing emissions of particulate matter size 2.5 microns and less. I don't see that addressed in these regulations anywhere. how we're reducing those emissions. I don't see the 50% reduction in life cycle greenhouse gas emissions compared to high efficiency units such as natural gas or the fuel that is most likely to be utilized. I don't see that in these regulations. There is some discussion in here, and I'll get a little more specific. But these regulations are not addressing the mandate that is in the legislation, especially when it comes to biomass. So the loophole is large enough to drive a logging truck through or a feller buncher or whatever piece of equipment you want to drive through it. The other section that specifically says in the Act is that in consultation with the Department of Conservation and Recreation, the fuel shall be provided that sustainable forestry practices. I have not seen DCR come up with a definition of sustainable forestry practices. That DCR themselves have never practiced sustainable forestry on a large scale. I can take you to Pureflex in the Quabbin and throughout Western Mass, where DCR has practiced horrific logging, and they admitted it during the Forest Futures process that they made a lot of mistakes. So we currently have a program in the Quabbin Reservoir where the state plans to cut 2% of the trees every year for the next 50 years. There is nothing sustainable about that. A 50-year rotation is nothing near sustainable. So they said, the Act said, that DCR would go through a process and they will adopt standards after a public comment process. That has not happened. I have not participated in that. And so these regulations are very premature in that regard. I don't think you can do this without them doing that first. It does say in consultation, and I guess we need to see the proof that that consultation has happened and that the public hearings have occurred for the sustainability part of that. The department may provide, this is the Act, that certain non-emitting renewable technologies shall get alternative energy credits as well. I think that you should focus on that. At this point, I believe, and I'll go down the sections, I believe that you should remove from the definitions under eligible biomass fuel A and C. So that's eligible biomass woody fuel, remove that, and manufactured biomass fuel, remove that. Under the definition of eligible biomass woody fuel, remove that definition entirely. Continuing on, that would be section A, B, C, and D, which is forest-derived thinnings, forest salvage, non-forest-derived residues. I believe all of those sections should be removed. Non-forest-derived residues, if you wanted to focus on something under 4D, number 1 and number 2 would be the limit that I would suggest. And those are manufactured products. So there is some carbon, long-term carbon sequestration possible during that processing. But otherwise, thinning and other things, there's no long-term carbon sequestration occurring during thinnings, during removing materials, during salvage, or any of that stuff. And there, the process that you follow for coming up with, I'm not sure what, the APS guideline on biomass, biofuels, and biogas. I don't know if that document is something that is coming in the future or if that was supposed to be appended to this. It's referred to several times in the regulations, and it's something that will be updated from time to time. I guess it would be good to know what that is before these regulations are passed. And continuing on through, I guess, I'm not even sure what section we're in anymore, but it looks like section 5, efficient, no, section 6, the APS renewable thermal generation units. There's a section in there that talks about net carbon dioxide emissions, and I am not clear reading through this. It says the department in consultation with DEP shall publish net carbon dioxide average emissions. I'm not sure if that's referring to offsets throughout that section. It's just not very clear. If the net carbon dioxide emission has to do with forests regrowing in order for that to be considered net, then there is nothing in this regulation, absolutely nothing, that assures, that guarantees that those forests will in fact regrow. There is no way to guarantee that. And as we've seen with the RPS data that the state has provided, there is no follow-up. There is essentially no monitoring to make sure that those forests that are considered some kind of a credit, an offset, to say that those forests have actually regrown. There's no certification process afterwards. There's no restriction on re-entering those forests after they've been certified. There's nothing. It's a make-believe program. There aren't standards. There aren't standards that are being followed. So without having some kind of a program, the entire Section 4D should be removed from these regulations. And that has to do with the standards for eligible biomass and APS, renewable thermal generation unit. Unless there's some mechanism for enforcement and monitoring, then this is just fantasy. It's just make-believe. I mean, we're not talking about lands that have any kind of guarantee that they will be maintained and forested. As long as necessary to recover first from the disturbance, to count how many decades it takes for them to break even, and then to accumulate the amount of emissions that occurred when those trees were burned. Not considering the impact to soil carbon, which also needs to be included in the equation. The carbon in a forest is like a bucket. The larger the bucket, the more carbon the forest can store. This program makes the bucket smaller, and it punches holes throughout the bucket so that it essentially becomes a sieve for a long time. For the time period that matters, we're talking about the next 20 years are critical for reducing significantly, drastically reducing carbon emissions. And under this program, that is not going to happen. So my feeling is that those sections should be removed. They can be put into regulations at some point in the future when a real study has been done, when real data is available. But my final comment is about air emissions. The legislation specifically requires emission standards, and there is nothing in this proposed regulation that actually deals with emission standards. It just has words like shall minimize, or use low air emission levels in accordance with these guidelines, the APS guidelines. That kind of wording is not sufficient to meet the intent of the Act, which was to reduce PM2.5, reduce it. In addition, as was pointed out, there is nothing in this set of regulations before us that guarantees that these facilities will be reducing the greenhouse gas emissions, not counting offsets, by 20% by 2020, and by 80% by 2050, and those regulations from DEP need to be in place for this regulated industry before these regulations can be put in place. Or you're putting the cart before the horse, or whatever term you want to use. I'll submit this in writing, but my suggestion at this point is that these regulations are not ready for prime time. They should be either withdrawn, or they should be significantly reduced to focus on truly renewable energy sources, solar and other thermal technologies, and that we are not ready to deal with the issue of biomass, because I'm sorry, but you have not done your homework. Thank you.
Thank you. The last speaker is Beth Adams.
Hey, everyone, thank you for the opportunity to speak at this hearing today. A former public school teacher and professional social worker, I'm not a scientist. But I do wish to acknowledge and include the comments that PFPI is including, because they thankfully laboriously reviewed the new proposed state regs on thermal energy. Biomass and pellet energy, well, I'm going to include two pieces, two letters. One is an editorial that's entitled, "Dear Congress, Burning Wood is Not the Future of Energy." It's from April 28th this year from the Washington Post. And just yesterday, there was a letter signed by at least, it looks like 50 organizations to a congressional committee on the same topic topics that I want to talk about today. And there are only two. I have one page. I'm going to revise the page. I don't like, now I've been writing on it. I want to do a better job, so I'll email it to you. But the two main topics are this. Biomass and pellet energy being supported by the Massachusetts Forest Alliance and the Commonwealth are antiquated burning methods for heat and power that have two major problems. One, they accelerate climate change. CO2 in the atmosphere on Monday was 407.50 parts per million in the atmosphere. Through the loss of the carbon sink effects of sequestration due to deforestation, 1 acre of mature forest sequesters 30,000 pounds of CO2. That's from a study that was completed by Cornell. B, massive immediate releases of CO2 from the soil after logging operations are completed continue on for decades. C, in the case of biomass burning, whether for just heat or for both heat and power, emits more CO2 than coal and many other toxic pollutants. And D, in the case of pellet manufacturing, life cycle emits more CO2 than coal, as you heard from Mary Boog. In addition to climate damaging results mentioned above, it disrupts the ecosystem, interdependent plant and animal species, including interwoven life forms within the forest floor. Do we want to be responsible for that kind of activity? And number two, biomass and pellet burning are both bad for health. Human health, plant health, animal health. I know something about health because as of 2014, I'm facing two physical battles, lung cancer and multiple myeloma, which is a chronic cancer of the plasma. Did these arise from air pollution? My guess is they either arose from air pollution or water pollution, or maybe a combination of both. You know, when things go into the air, they go into the ground, and then they go into our water. So it's very clear that pellet burning and biomass cause cancer, asthma, heart disease, and stroke. Our public health costs will be going up if we institute these regulations, if we don't eliminate, as Glenn Ayers has said, these putting biomass and pellet burning on the front burner in Massachusetts. Let's see. So, pellets in particular, no pun intended, emit large amounts of particulate matter, often containing considerable amounts of heavy metals. And the American Lung Association and the Breast Cancer Coalition of Massachusetts have both come out against biomass and pellet burning. And also, they've come out against the new proposal to manufacture and distribute pellets called the Mohawk Trails Woodlands Partnership. It's a $23 million proposal to fund pellet burners in dozens of Massachusetts schools through SAFOR fire grants. I thought it was just like a few schools, maybe in Western Mass, Mohawk, five other schools. I was shocked to read that they're trying to do this in like dozens of schools throughout the state. So it would be located west of Greenfield, this manufacturing facility. And then if you look at the map, it includes all the forests in Franklin and Western Mass. In Berkshire County, sorry. So, don't you think that our tax dollars could be better spent on building something? Well, okay, I want to finish on that score one more piece of that. Because the SAFIRE grants, I think, should be going for retrofitting these schools. I've seen the Hitchcock building, which is a light building. And, sorry, I've got to slow down. It's a living building. It's a large building. You know, a lot of us think, oh, we can use solar on solar for small buildings and homes and residential. But this is a huge building, like a school or a college, and it's energy efficient in its construction, but then it has air source heat pumps and mini splits for both heating and cooling. And you know, we're going to get warmer and warmer up here in Massachusetts and New England, and so we're going to need to cool much more than we have, and earlier, as we know from our weather this year. So, shouldn't the taxpayers of Massachusetts be spending our energy dollars to transition to greener, cleaner heating and cooling and power options? We could then, as I said, retrofit building, install air source heat pumps and mini splits for heating and cooling. Our agents in government would be well advised to help lift the cap on solar installation and support offshore wind and wave energy. Do you know that it's a very up-and-coming technology that's first started as a pilot north of Ellsworth in Maine? I think it's in, I can't remember, but it's north of, it's near Machias, Maine, where they have wave technology, and it's very successful and very renewable. So these are technologies. We have a coastline. It's at risk, of course, with the with more and more emissions and our parts per million going up all the time. But I imagine that it could be designed in such a way that even with rising sea level, that the wave technology could be useful. So we would be well advised to use our dollars that way than spending them on dirty, unhealthy pellet and biomass burning, so detrimental to climate and public health. And I hope that those who have forests would use them. We could subsidize a wood products industry again in Massachusetts. We could also use forests, but there'll be plenty of need for the private homeowner. And so what I'm speaking about here is commercial level, and I think you are for your regulations as well. Largely these are to regulate commercial facilities. So I agree that we should be doing more research, and we should have research-based studies. Tim Surchinger, who's a scholar and and very well versed on this accounting for carbon emissions, has said that obtaining 4%, just 4% of the carbon electricity from biomass would require 74% of its timber harvest. So this would, as he said, promote deforestation in the United States and elsewhere and make climate change much, much worse. So I think I'll end there.
If there are any other members here at the public hearing that would like to speak, just put your hand up and give us your name. If you're representing an organization, name the organization. We've got time left for the public hearing, so if anyone's here who wasn't on the sign-up sheet who'd like to offer some comments, please do. Going once. In the back.
Can you guys field questions in this forum?
We can intake comments on the regulations as proposed. This is not a question and answer opportunity. Yes?
I have an additional quick comment on the air emissions. This is Mary Booth, Partnership for Policy Integrity.
Thank you.
I believe that my reading of it is that the standard for emissions for particulate matter is 0.08 parts, parts per million, sorry, 0.08 pounds per million BTU on heat input basis. But the SAPPHIRE program specified 0.03 pounds per million BTU for schools, you know, areas near sensitive populations, which is totally achievable by many of these units. And I cannot understand why you would have picked such a much higher standard for this. That's my reading of it. Maybe I'm wrong, but I'll look at it more carefully before we submit our written comments. But it certainly seems to me that you didn't go anywhere close to putting in place protective standards on the particulate matter.
Okay, thank you. Sir?
Will there be an opportunity to ask questions before the comment period is up on June 30th?
You can submit questions for clarifications, for example. I suggest the email account that we utilize when we publish, that would be an acceptable method to input those questions for clarification. You're welcome. The public hearing is scheduled until 3. We will remain until 3. I'm going to turn, if nobody else has any other comments, I'll turn the recorder off so I'm not just recording dead air. But if anybody else would like to make a comment later on, we'll stay here until 3 and leave the public hearing open until then. But otherwise, I thank you all for your comments and your time. And we're after those.